Coming up in no particular order, how much would it take to make you go see that Entourage movie, Why do we have National Accordion Awareness Month anyway? And why isn't money transfer more digital in this digital age? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. June is upon us. Today is the first of the month. It's a Monday. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It's been the first of the month since midnight. That's kind of the way things work, you know, which is also when select parts of the Patriot Act were allowed to lapse. A deal will likely be worked out in the next couple of days. But in the meanwhile, Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons gets us going with phone companies and your data.
The new bill would shift the responsibility of data storage from the NSA to telecom companies. Tim Shorrock, author of Spies for Hire, says telecoms and the NSA, it goes back to the 50s.
The NSA used to send a guy up to New York every morning to bring back the sort of metal, you know, recordings that the telecoms had made of telephone calls going to and fro in the United States and foreign countries, and, you know, take the train back in the evening, and the NSA would, you know, go through those calls.
Shorrock says in times of crisis, U.S. telecom companies have been quick to comply.
You know, NSA leaders have, you know, directors have, you know, actually, you know, just called up CEOs of these companies and said, you've got to do this. And when there's an incident like 9/11, obviously, you know, people react.
In fact, in 2008, Congress gave telecoms retroactive immunity for forking over customers' data to the intelligence agencies. So if the USA Freedom Act were to give telecoms more control, it might not change much in terms of citizens' privacy. But one thing's different, the country's attitude toward NSA surveillance. Let's try a hypothetical. Say one internet provider or phone company decides to take a stand and advertise its new role as the protector of privacy. We keep your data safe. That might not make much of a difference either, says Cindy Cohn, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
So if you've got a small ISP, but it sits on top of AT&T or it sits on top of Sprint, even if they couldn't get it from the little ISP or the little telecommunications carrier, they can go upstream, and generally those records are available.
So don't worry. The intelligence community has covered its bases for now. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham made it official today. He's in. Wants to be the next president, which means that in addition to a campaign biography, more position papers than you know what to do with, and fundraisers galore, there will likely soon be T-shirts, bumper stickers, and coffee mugs, too, because a campaign ain't nothing without a campaign store. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
Let's do some hard-hitting campaign analysis. What are the candidates selling? No, seriously, on their online stores. Let's start with Hillary Clinton.
She's got this great little onesie there that's sort of the future voter onesie.
Howard Belk is co-CEO of global branding firm Siegel & Gale. He says you can tell how confident a candidate is feeling just from their online store.
Hillary has essentially been, you know, coronated as a Democratic candidate unless something really surprising happens.
So Belk says you can see it in the relatively witty merchandise she's selling, like her think tank tank top.
But on the Republican side, it's a dogfight.
Belk says because the Republican field is so crowded, many candidates are afraid to be funny because they might alienate potential voters. So they're overthinking every coffee mug and bumper sticker, which can result in merchandise that can be a little blah. Jonah Berger teaches marketing at Wharton. He says, remember, candidates are brands, too.
Consumer psychology drives the decisions we make, whether it's from the milk we buy at the store to the person we elect for president.
We're more likely to support a candidate, Berger says, if our friends and family do. So what does he think all that merchandise says about the candidates?
That's a little tough for me because I'm not sure there's much variation.
Sounds like what a cynical voter would say about politics in general. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You want to see some of the weirdest campaign merchandise offered by candidates this year? We've got a video, marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, baby steps, y'all, baby steps. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was news out of Bangladesh overnight, a follow-up to the collapse of a garment factory in Dhaka 2 years ago that killed 1,100 people. 42 people, including the owner of the Rana Plaza, the building that collapsed, and a dozen government officials now face charges ranging from building code violations to homicide. 17 of them face murder charges. Akbar Hussain, the BBC's correspondent in Dhaka, is on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What has the reaction been so far about these charges?
The reaction so far is very positive from different quarters, because finally they have seen, even after 2 years, the charges have been framed. So now they're waiting about the trial process. Once they are convicted in the lower court, then the convicted persons, they have every right to go to the high court. So this is a long process which will take time. So garment factory workers and their rights activists, they are saying they want to see these people to be punished in future.
Have you seen improvements in the condition of the workers since this collapse happened 2 years ago? I mean, there were promises by Western companies that they would inspect more, that they would do more. Have you seen any of that?
Yeah, we have seen few positive changes, because after the Rana Plaza disaster, more than 3,500 factories have been inspected by the inspectors appointed by European and American initiative. So now things are going on. And what the interesting thing is that in last 2 years, we haven't seen major disaster in Bangladesh's garment factory, not any fire incident or building or factory collapse, something like that. But how long it will continue, that's a big question.
I wonder how much of the delay in this investigation, how much of the 2 years, was because garment factory owners and manufacturers over there are so powerful. They have so much influence in the government and in the economy.
We have seen in the past many fire incidents where hundreds of people, garment factory workers, were killed. But no one was punished for that. So this time, when the incident was so big, more than 1,100 workers had died, all the local and international media, they were keeping a very close eye on the incident. Mm. And garment factory owners, they were creating a pressure on the government. But the government, they had to be firm on their stance and the investigation must be completed. So that's why it was taking so long. Government officials who were accused initially, they were also creating problem in the investigation process. Mm.
Are these good jobs to have?
Look, Bangladesh is a country of 160 million people. And more than 40 million people are living under poverty level, who earns less than $2 in a day. The government estimate says more than 7 million people are working in the garment industry. Most of them are female. And many people are looking job in the garment industry because they don't have other option. So this is a big sector in Bangladesh where garment workers can find a job easily. And they're providing a lot of employment opportunities for poor people, especially who live in village or rural areas.
Akbar Hussain with the BBC in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Akbar, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
If you've got a credit card and can get yourself online, you can buy a pair of pants from China, say, and have it pretty much at your front door within a week. And in 2015, honestly, it's exactly what we'd expect, right? Not snail mail, but email, not catalogs, but e-commerce. If you want to send $50 to an actual individual human being in China or the Dominican Republic or Tajikistan, for that matter, you can. And millions of people do send billions of dollars in what are called remittances. But the journey that money takes has most definitely not kept up with the digital times. Stan Alcorn explains.
In the U.S., the journey usually begins at a place like Daisy Travel. It's a storefront in the mostly Dominican neighborhood of Washington Heights in New York City, selling cell phones at a counter in front and Western Union money transfers at what looks like a movie ticket window in back.
This is like the typical setup, but like there's a Western Union in the back.
Edricio de la Cruz used to come to a place like this between college classes and a night shift as a plane mechanic at the JFK airport in order to send money to his Aunt Virginia in the Dominican Republic.
Typically, that experience was relatively painful because you had to take time out of your day, stand online, fill out a form.
And pay a fee of at least 10%. But that wasn't as painful as what he saw on the other side, when 15 years ago a teenage De La Cruz visited his aunt in Santo Domingo.
I accompanied my aunt to go pick up the money and see, like, oh my God, this is like the Flintstones.
It wasn't quite cars made out of rocks, but he had to deal with the fact that every money transfer has two parts. The first part is just messaging. Aunt Virginia gets a code to identify her to the Western Union in Santo Domingo, and that Western Union gets a direction to hand over cash to Aunt Virginia, for which it gets a kind of IOU. Back then, this all meant long-distance phone cards and waiting by the landline. That part has evolved.
One of the things that you see most here is cell phone stores.
Now, messaging can take place over the internet and on mobile phones.
The messaging part is now almost free.
Dilip Ratha tracks money transfers for the World Bank.
And yet, the average fee is still about 8%. 8%.
8% is less than 15 years ago, but it still seems too high to Ratha.
The true cost of sending money is definitely close to zero or below 1%.
But the true cost also depends on how expensive it is to do the second part of the money transfer, the part where they actually move money.
We hear so much about, you know, this is so important for certain countries. Why can't it be for free?
Pam Patsley is the CEO of MoneyGram, the second biggest money transfer company after Western Union. She says her company's fees average only 5%, and half of that goes to pay those agents at cell phone stores, banks, and travel agencies, of which they have 350,000 across the globe. And out of MoneyGram's 2.5%, they're spending tens of millions of dollars a year complying with regulations to fight fraud and money laundering. And then, finally, there's the system for actually collecting the cash from, say, the New York travel agency that sent it and paying back the agent in Santo Domingo that received it.
Your receiver may have picked up their money within an hour, but we won't pay that receive agent or collect from that send agent until maybe 8 hours later.
This is the part that hasn't changed as much. It relies on sending money through a chain of banks, from local to global, back to local, more than 800 accounts in total in MoneyGram's case. And it's this tangled web that Edricio de la Cruz hoped to cut through when he started a company called Regali, right across the street from Daisy Travel in Washington Heights.
Regali?
But now, instead of replacing the MoneyGrams and Western Unions, his employees are on the phone trying to get money transfer companies as partners.
So what are the main corridors that you guys remit to from the UK?
It's like, if you want to go to California, you can take a railroad and stop at like 20 different cities. Or you can take a jet. We're not taking jets yet, money transfer. We're taking railroads.
Regali rides the rails of the money transfer companies. It just cuts out the last station, making it possible to pay his aunt's electricity bill directly for a slightly lower fee. He's not trying to build a jet, a totally new way to send money across borders, but he is one of the many people pushing for a slightly faster and cheaper train. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Coming up.
People who aren't Entourage fans even are like, yeah, we definitely have to go see it now.
What thousands of dollars and a good cause will make a person do. But first, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 29 points on this first trading day of a brand new month. That's 10th percent. Finished at 18,040, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 12 points, about a quarter percent, 5,082. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, closed at 2111. Intel chipped off 1.6%. Today, the tech giant said it's buying fellow chipmaker Altera for $17 billion in cash. Altera tore up 5.8% today on the news. Still, with tech software and services companies, had a real nice day. eBay traded up 2.7%. Intuit crept up 2.1%. The healthcare companies were in good shape. Bristol Myers Squibb and Intuitive Surgical both gained nearly 3%. Airline stocks ditto. Delta cruised up 3.33%. United Continental glided up 3.1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.18%. And you, yes, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for April. June is National Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Month. Eat up. And speaking of fruit, tomorrow's full moon is called the Full Strawberry Moon. It's related to strawberry harvest season. And here you thought the moon was made of cheese. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. At the Council of Fashion Designers of America Awards Gala tonight in New York City, Instagram founder Kevin Systrom is going to get the group's Media Award. It's going to be presented, perhaps inevitably, by Kim Kardashian. Kardashian, I guess it is, who has more followers on Instagram than anybody except Instagram, the company itself. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains Instagram and fashion are what you might call a perfect fit.
Rachel Fuentes is a second grade teacher, and she, like many of us, is on Instagram a lot.
I actually check it when I wake up, and anytime I have a break, I'll check into it.
Admit it, you probably do too. But for Fuentes, it's not just about pretty pictures.
Instagram has become my one way of shopping.
When it comes to clothes and fashion, she follows small local boutiques right on up to Nordstrom's.
And if I catch their Insta sale, which is their Instagram sale, if it's cute and if I like it, I will automatically just will purchase it.
But the photos that come through Fuentes' feed?
They're definitely not ads.
They're photos of models or outfits, and you don't have to be a major brand to have nice photos. Gretchen Harnick is a professor of fashion marketing at the New School.
It's really allowing startups to have a voice right alongside of bigger brands.
It's also brought all fashion, whether the most exclusive New York runway to the hipster jewelry maker, directly into the feeds of people who voluntarily want to see these things. It's advertising gold.
There is definitely a tangible gain in the fashion industry from Instagram.
Marlene Morris-Towns teaches at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
I think that it has done wonders for brand awareness and people actually engaging with the brand.
And they do engage. Gucci, for example, has 4 million followers on Instagram. Nike has 16 million. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today is the 1st of June, which means we have arrived at the official kickoff of National Accordion Awareness Month. That actually happens to be a true thing, by the way. June the 1st, the day itself, has several individual distinctions. It is National Say Something Nice Day, for just one example. Listener Katie Rolls wrote all the way from Australia to ask about that way we have here of having national days of, it seems like, anything you can think of. How do they get picked? And who's in charge of them? Perfect fodder, I would say, for our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
From WYSO, Lewis Wallace is on it.
Let's start with International Talk Like a Pirate Day. That's one of the days Katie was wondering about. It's celebrated across YouTube each September.
Yo ho, yo ho, it's Talk Like a Pirate Day.
But just to narrow it down, I'm focusing on today, Monday, June 1st. It's a pretty busy day. There's Go Barefoot Day, started by an organization that gives shoes to underprivileged kids. Pen Pal Day, the woman behind that is a pen pal enthusiast out of Chicago. And, of course, Say Something Nice Day. Mitch Carnell is behind that one.
Because once you say something, it's out there. You can't call it back.
Carnell submitted his idea in 2006 to Chase's. That's a yearly almanac that acts as a sort of loose gatekeeper for national days and months. But not all national days are listed there. There's another resource, a website, nationaldaycalendar.com. I reached the site's co-founder, Marlo Anderson. How does something become a national day?
There's a couple ways it can happen. Of course, a company or an individual can just declare it, and a lot of people do.
Point being, really anyone can make up a national day of blank. There's no accreditation process or government agency. Though Anderson says they don't approve just any old day that comes across their desk.
In the last year, we've received over 10,000 requests for national days.
Out of the 10,000, he says they typically take about 20 to 25 days each year. They'll focus on iconic items over brands, say National Coffee Day as opposed to National Starbucks Day, and they look for things everyone can enjoy or be a part of. And what about the most common request they say no to?
You know, it's my girlfriend of 3 months, and she's changed my life forever. Can I have National Heather Day? You know, that's a very, very popular thing.
But most of these national days are recent inventions that have spread around on social media. As far as I can find, only one of the June 1st celebrations goes back to before the internet, and that's National Heimlich Maneuver Day.
I do not know who wrote the article on it that made it come about.
And yes, that is Dr. Henry Heimlich. He's now 95. Heimlich published an article about his life-saving maneuver on June 1st, 1974.
Immediately, lives were being saved.
At some point, a day was declared, though he's not sure exactly how. Dr. Heimlich is pretty amused to learn that he's now competing with National Hazelnut Cake Day.
I guess people can choke on that, too.
Well, hazelnut cake might not be for everyone, but it's your day. Go celebrate. Take off your shoes, say something nice, maybe help out a choking neighbor. And meanwhile, start polishing up on talking like a pirate, ready for September.
B-E-I-O-U-R.
On National Heimlich Maneuver Day, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
If you've got something you've always wondered about, hit us up. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. The movie remake of the HBO show Entourage opens day after tomorrow. Early reviews are promising, but not everybody's a fan. You can count among that faction one Wendy Molyneux, by day a television writer, by night somebody who really doesn't want to go see that movie. She started a GoFundMe campaign that will have her, though, at last count and for a good cause, going to see Entourage not once, but twice. Wendy, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Why are you doing this?
Well, it actually started as actually a joke. My husband and I went to see Mad Max, and there was an Entourage preview beforehand, and we were joking about how much – this is something we actually do frequently – how much money would it take you to do some task?
Oh, yeah.
Like drive to Vegas, get out of your car, get right back in and drive home, like at an exact moment in time.
$10,000. I would do that for $10,000.
Yeah, so you could do this fundraiser too.
That's right.
You know, I would see the Entourage movie for $10,000.
And you hate Entourage that much?
Well – I mean, I hate it in quotes, yes, as much as you can get up ire about a television show.
And lo and behold, you set up this GoFundMe thing, and boy, do you get funded.
Yeah. Before I left the house on Tuesday morning, I think it was Tuesday, I said to my husband, I was like, could you go give me $25 so that at least this will make $25? Because I'm like, oh my God.
On the site, yeah.
Yeah.
And what the heck? I mean, as it stands now, you've got $24,000. You're going to have to go see this thing several times, I gather?
I have to see it twice because I got to $20,000.
Yeah.
I have to wear a pair of Drama Mama pajamas as a tribute to the character Johnny Drama. And my sister Lizzie, who's my writing partner, made me a sipping cup for my soda that has turtle on the outside. We're well into this now, so
expectations. But you totally got to go all
in. If as it sort of goes along this week, it were to get to 30, I'm going to see it four times.
You have had, first of all, Turtle himself, Jerry Ferrara, has donated,
yes,
as have Eric Stonestreet and Megan Mullally. I mean, a lot of people are in this thing.
Yeah, everyone was like, Jerry Ferrara is amazing. Like,
cool.
People who aren't Entourage fans even are like, yeah, we definitely have to go see it now. So in a way, this whole thing has turned around. And I offered something where for $150 or more, we'd all go, I'd buy a ticket for whoever gave that much or more. And so now, ironically, I will be spending more on Entourage tickets than anyone in America.
Just like Kickstarter, you've got a whole set of incentives and rewards and all that jazz.
Yeah.
We should say this is all in pursuit of a very serious cause.
Yes. The cause we're giving money to is CureSearch. They aggressively look for cures for pediatric cancer exclusively because sometimes treating children's cancer is very different than treating adult cancer.
Yeah.
We have a family connection to it because, unfortunately, my nephew, my sister and brother-in-law's youngest son passed away from complications from leukemia. And, you know, we don't want to look away and we want to encourage people to get involved. And, you know, even if you have to do something silly to be like, hey, look at this thing over here that you don't know anything about, because those cancers do strike randomly. It's just nice to have people be aware that that cause is out there and to give them a little boost in their work.
It's crowdfunding with a little bit of a twist, right?
Yes, with a twist.
Wendy Molyneux. Wendy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which I dare you, I say, to tell me we are not in a tech bubble. There's a new startup in San Francisco that will, and near as I can tell, this is a real thing, it'll take your trash cans out to the curb for you on trash day. You fill out a form, you tell them where your trash cans are, side of the house, back of the house, garage, whatever. And I guess you never have to worry about it again. $10 a week, 4 to 6 cans, you're all set. I am honestly kind of hoping this is a joke and I just missed it. All righty, that's it. We are done. The Dow up 29 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 12, about a 0.25%. The S&P 500 rose 4 points. That is 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Austin Cross, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.